Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Anne Wennerstrand, and today we have the great honor of speaking with Dr. Mark Epstein about his newest work, The Trauma of Everyday Life, which was just released in paperback by Penguin Books. First, a brief intro. Mark Epstein is a psychiatrist in private practice in New York City and the author of a number of books about the interface of Buddhism and psychotherapy, including Thoughts Without a Thinker, Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, Going On Being, Open to Desire, and Psychotherapy Without the Self. He received his undergraduate and medical degrees from Harvard University and is currently clinical assistant professor in the postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at New York University. The Trauma of Everyday Life uses the Buddha's biography as a means of exploring the hidden psychodynamic and contemporary relevance of Buddhist thought. Adam Phillips, who was actually interviewed here a few months ago on our podcast, has said of Mark Epstein, he is one of the very few writers who has been able to make the connections between psychoanalysis and Buddhism seem not merely interesting, but somehow riveting and useful. And I certainly would agree with that assessment. So without further ado, Mark, I'd like to welcome you to New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Hey, thank you so much, Anne.
And thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm really been very excited about this interview and, you know, immersing myself in the book, and so rich and lucid, and there's so much to say and kind of hard to know exactly where to start. But I thought I would start where you did, which is really that this book, it begins with an analysis of the Buddha's life. It's really what I would call a psychobiographical case study. Would you call it that?
Yeah.
Okay. You identify a trauma that occurred early in the Buddha's infancy and study how the impact of that trauma informed the Buddha's spiritual journey, as well as his teachings and his life. Including, you know, incorporating Winnicott's notion of primitive agony. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about that and tell the listeners how you came to write this book.
Sure. Well, as I think you know, I've been interested in Buddhism for a very long time, and my interest in Buddhism actually predated my training as a medical doctor, as a psychiatrist, as a psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had that kind of unusual history of being immersed in Buddhism first, and then all my training, I was kind of looking at the psychotherapeutic tradition through this Buddhist lens.
Mm.
So, I've written all those books that you mentioned. This book did begin as an attempt in a kind of Erik Eriksonian tradition to be a psychobiography in my own way of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
It turned into something else, you know, into a discussion of trauma, but the thread of the early trauma in the Buddha's life is there in the book, and it's a primary element of the book. And It's based on the fact, which has not been discussed very much, the fact that as far as we know, the Buddha was a real person, mm-hmm. and his mother, in all the reports of the actual Buddha's life, his mother died when he was just 7 days old. Mm. And that fact, I kind of knew it in the back of my mind, but it dawned on me one day when I was teaching a workshop with Professor Robert Thurman of Columbia, who's a friend and colleague, and I often teach with him. And he spontaneously pulled out a poem by an 18th century Mongolian Lama, an enlightenment poem that written right in the aftermath of this Lama's final realization, where he begins, "I was like a mad child, long lost my old mother, never could find her, though she was with me always." Hmm. And he compares that feeling of finding the lost mother to the discovery of what the Buddhists call emptiness. And I was filled with a lot of energy when I heard him read this poem, which he had translated. And I started to think about all these connections and thought that maybe I could make something out of the fact that the Buddha's mother died when he was a week old, that that was like a stand-in for all of the early traumas that happen that we maintain in our bodies but can't really remember.
Right. And you take us through the book so skillfully in terms of looking at what the clinical manifestations are of that early trauma, more as a contemporary analyst might do a case study and see where the repetitions occurred and where the dissociation occurred and what the manic defenses are and what the resolution is. And I think you say in the book, although I'm not exactly sure, that this was really one of the great self-analyses of all history, was the Buddha's own self-analysis.
Yeah, I might not have been firm in my pronouncement,
right.
but I'm sure I said something about how it is one of the first examples that we have historically of a successful self-analysis,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting to make the parallels between that and Freud's cocaine-influenced self-analysis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you make of the fact that even Buddhist scholars, we could say they overlooked, we could say that they unconsciously forgot that detail of the Buddha's early history?
Well, I don't know that they overlooked or forgot as much as they used it in a different way.
Uh-huh.
You know, the material is there. It's in the early sutras, and even as Buddhism morphed and changed and, you know, moved from culture to culture, the reference to the death of the Buddha's mother is maintained. The original explanation for her death is that, historically speaking, according to the Buddhist cosmology, you know, this is not the only Buddha. This is the Buddha of our era.
Mm-hmm.
But in previous eras, there are said to have been other Buddhas. And for every Buddha, when he leaves home at the age of 29 in order to seek his liberation, it was thought to be, that leaving of home was thought to be too painful for the mother. It would be too unkind for the mother. So in order to protect the mother from the trauma of his leaving home, they have her die early. So there are pronouncements in the sutras, you know, don't worry about this. She's really better off. She went mm-hmm. to a heaven realm where she could watch the progress of her son. And one of the first things that the Buddha does after his enlightenment is he goes to the heaven realm where his mother is, and teaches her the essentials of his psychology, which is called the Abhidharma, which mm-hmm. means the ultimate doctrine, the Buddhist psychology. So he bores her to death with the Buddhist psychology once he has that ability to move between worlds.
Hmm. It was very interesting. So you started in your creative process from the more of the historical and moved towards the clinical from there?
Yeah, in my mind, it was all mushed up together.
Mm-hmm.
I've been heavily influenced by the work of Donald Winnicott,
mm-hmm.
who I think was one of the first in the psychoanalytic tradition to really emphasize the role of the mother,
mm-hmm.
and also to talk about what we call pre-Oedipal or early relational
mm-hmm.
kinds of experiences and developmental traumas that come when a mother or father is either too intrusive or too abandoning, and there's a kind of malattunement in the early relationship. And he's the one who coined the phrase of primitive agony, which
mm-hmm.
I use in the book to talk about some of the disturbances that can happen in the years before language sets in. So, when emotional experience is so strong, but a child doesn't have the words to put on the experience,
right.
then they're really dependent on the parents for help in interpreting affective experience. And I knew when I heard that poem of the Mongolian Lama that I wanted to make all these connections between Buddhist thought and psychoanalytic, particularly Winnicottian thought.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me the writing of the book to tease out, as many of the connections as I could find.
Right. And you do later on, we'll sort of go through some more of the chronology of the book, and you talk a lot about how those traumatic effects take up residence in the body when there are no words to express those primitive agonies. I found that really interesting.
I tell the story in the book of my friend Sharon Salzberg, who
mm-hmm.
was on a long-term meditation retreat with a well-known Burmese Buddhist teacher. And she was unaccountably feeling sad in the midst of her retreat, but was kind of ashamed of the feelings of sadness that she was having. She was crying in the privacy of her meditation and so on. But she didn't want to tell the Burmese teacher about it.
Mm.
You know, she just kind of hinted. And that shame that we often feel about our own emotional distress, you know, that we feel like, oh, that's not the spiritual part of ourselves, that's the psychological part of ourselves, and we kind of have to hide that. She was acting like that with him. And he sensed enough of it to press her on it. And she finally admitted that she was crying, while she was trying to meditate. And he said something very moving to her, which was, when you're feeling sad, when you're meditating, you know, you should cry with your whole heart.
Mm.
And I thought that was a nice example of the merging of the psychotherapeutic and the meditative traditions. You know, we often want to keep them apart, but for me, they've really been one and the same.
Right, and that's something in the clinical encounter we would encourage in a safe, you know, sort of if there's a good enough relational hold. I wanted to go back a little bit. I actually had been very familiar with your work over the years, but I hadn't known about this latest book until I encountered an editorial that you wrote in the New York Times last year. And I think it was August of 2013.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, and it was a piece in which you talked about your mother's process of grieving your father who had died and her sense of not feeling that it was okay to sort of dwell in her grief. And I was wondering if you could say something about that, because I think that there's a very heavy emphasis in the culture on moving on and, you know, sort of rushing back to normal and, you know, going through these very distinct stages of grief and then sort of having it all be done. And I think that's very problematic. And your language and the way you wrote it at the time just really, really spoke to me.
Yeah, I think the editorial was called The Trauma of Being Alive.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of surprised. You know, I had just finished writing the book, and I was having this conversation with my mother. I think it was about 4 years, maybe, after my father had died. They had been married for, you know, what seemed like their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And he had died of a brain tumor that had kind of crept mm-hmm. up on him from the silent side of his brain. So he had his cognitive facilities right until the end, but mm-hmm. then he just passed, you know. So I was talking to my mother, and she was basically saying, like, she wasn't over it yet. Mm. And I was not totally surprised to hear her speaking that way, but surprised enough that I said something to her about, you know, why does it have to be over? We do have this compulsion, really, in the culture that in the book I call the rush to normal, mm-hmm. You know, move through the stages of grieving, a la Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, mm-hmm. and get to acceptance, and then be done with it. And I said something of that to my mother, and she responded, you know, kind of reflectively. Well, I guess you're right. It took me about 10 years after my first husband died before I really wasn't thinking about him all the time. And I thought, oh, that's great, except, you know,
first husband.
I remember, I didn't know you had a first husband. There was a time when I was about 12 or 14 when we were playing Scrabble, and I opened up the Webster's Dictionary to look up a word, and there I saw in her handwriting her name written with a different last name, and that was the first that I had ever heard of there being a life before me and before my father.
Right.
So that sense of having to keep secrets, I think my father was not necessary. That wasn't something my father necessarily wanted to be reminded of.
Right.
In the same way that that my mother now didn't really want to be reminded of her grief over the loss of my father.
So, right.
I tried to talk about all of that in that article, and people responded. That was a very popular piece.
It was really, I think in the book, I'm not sure if it was in the article, but one of the quotes you say in the book, there need be no end to grief. While it is mm-hmm. never static, it is not a single or even a five-stage thing. There is no reason to believe it will disappear for good, and no need to judge oneself if it does not. Grief turns over and over. It is vibrant, surprising, and alive, just as we are. And I found that personally meaningful. My mother died last year, and she was ill for quite some time. And luckily, I had some good people to to support me and talk to me and help me understand what my process was. But I found that grieving was something that began to kick in as soon as she was sort of diagnosed, and we didn't really know what was going on, and I wouldn't necessarily have known that that's the process I was in, but there is a way in which grief can be sort of, it can happen before the actual event of the death occurs.
One of the things that I like to say when I was thinking about this book and writing the book was that if we're not suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, we're suffering from pre-traumatic stress. Because mm-hmm. that underlying sense of the inevitability of change and therefore of loss is something that we know, but that we're fending off much of the time.
Right.
When something like you're talking about, when the diagnosis comes, you know, even before there's really any big change in terms of the loss, but it's hitting something that you already have been fearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big points that I'm always trying to make in the bringing together of psychoanalytic thought and Buddhist thought is that emotional experience does doesn't have to be something that we push away. Mm-hmm. And there's often a tendency from the Buddhist side to think that emotional experience is a problem, you know?
Right.
That the cause of suffering is desire, for instance, which is not exactly what the Buddha said, that attachment is somehow wrong, mm-hmm. that emotions are destructive, that in some sense we can't trust our deeper selves, when the actual teachings of the Buddha, I think, run counter to the way that many people over the centuries have interpreted them. Mm-hmm. And I think psychoanalysis in its own way is kind of refreshing for Buddhism because it's willing to talk about the wisdom, really, of intense emotional experience, not only joyful, pleasant emotional experience, but painful, angry, libidinal emotional experience.
Right.
That we can learn to navigate that and use it to have a deeper experience of ourselves in the world.
I think that's, you know, definitely something that's been written about and articulated by more contemporary Buddhists, and particularly Buddhists that wed psychoanalytic or Western psychological thought with Buddhist ideas. And I think that there is kind of a misperception, perhaps, and I don't know if I would say there are psychoanalysts who have the misperception, but this idea that there's been a minimization of aggression, or the sort of, we're supposed, if we're a Buddhist and we're meditating, we're supposed to get blissed out and not necessarily sit with our natural, our drives, our tendencies, our temperaments. I do think that's kind of a misperception based on what you're telling me right now.
Yeah. Well, I think that, there are many ways to interpret any kind of tradition, any kind of teaching. But one of the things that I tried to do in the book was to show how aggressive the Buddha really was, mm-hmm. in his own spiritual psychological search. And I've tried to tie a lot of that into the Winnicottian way of looking at the early loss of the mother, mm-hmm. in that it left him without a primary caregiver who could help him with his own aggression. He was brought up to be perfect, really, mm-hmm. in a way that's analogous to how a lot of our kids are brought up.
Right.
Not to talk about the loss. Everything was fine. He had, his aunt was the mother who stepped in. He probably had wet nurses. He was brought up in a princely environment, if we want to believe the myth. And everything was fine. But underneath was this kind of unsettled feeling that he couldn't really put a finger on, mm-hmm. that when he finally renounced his world and went in search of himself, he had to work through an awful lot of what we would call primitive aggression.
Right.
And you can see that in the story, in the story that's been handed down. If you want to look at it that way, you can see it that mm-hmm. way.
Well, following that, can you talk a little bit about if we're going to talk about it in terms of aggression, how mm-hmm. the Buddha turned aggression and sort of went on a self-attack, which I think we see with a lot of our patients, enacting in many different ways, whether it's self-harm or anorexia or addiction or, these things are to help regulate emotions probably, but there's also a way in which aggression and feeling is misdirected and directed back on the self. So when you talk about the Buddha renunciating, out into the forests, tell me more about your thinking about that in terms of what he was going through.
Well, the Buddhist teachings, are known as the middle way, mm-hmm. and they're called the middle way because he actually found something new. You know, he developed his own kind of therapy, basically, which moved between the two traditions, which were already popular in his time. So those two traditions were basically you could get blissed out in a transcendent way through various forms of yoga and meditation that were already part of the culture, or you could be an ascetic where you basically tried to free yourself of attachment to this coarse body with its desires and so on by subjecting yourself to all kinds of self-punishing kinds of practices. Mm-hmm. And there were big traditions in the Buddhist time already, major teachers, major therapists, we would say, of either of those traditions. And when the Buddha left his wife and young child, you know, he abandoned his son, much as he himself had been abandoned.
Right.
When he left his family and went into the forest in those days was like going to California or something, you know, to look for the New Age. The forest was the unstructured environment of the time where the spiritual seekers hung out, you know, outside of the constraints of clan and class and so on. So when he left the family and went to the forest, he studied with at first with great teachers of the transcendent blissful side, and he mastered those, you know, very, very quickly, and they asked him to stay and take over the being the guru, basically, which he rejected that because he felt, you know, as high as he got, it still wasn't taking care of the underlying disease that he was feeling. And then he embraced the ascetic practices. And in embracing the ascetic practices, if you read the descriptions, he sounds like a patient with anorexia.
Right.
You know, he basically
starved himself to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or nearly to death.
Creating, and the thing that I try to emphasize in the book is that when you work with someone with anorexia, as thin as they are, you know, as self-punishing as they might be, they're very, very strong individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, you know, it takes such work to break through at all the defenses, you know, or the law, the fortifications that an anorexic patient puts up around his or herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a real strength there. It might be misdirected in many of our views, but there's an attempt there to be so in control, you know, of oneself, of one's body, of one's desires, of one's time, of one's energy, to be so in control that the inevitable disruptions of everyday life can't penetrate you, you know?
It's like being, I always think of it as being above the fray, you know, sort of.
Yeah, that's a good way. That's a good phrase, I think, for what I'm trying to say. And the Buddha became very much like that. And the interesting thing, you know, in reading his life as a case history is that it was only at the height of his ascetic power, you know, that he had a childhood memory. And it's the only time that a childhood memory figures into the Buddhist scriptures. But he had a childhood memory just as he was falling over on himself through lack of food and water. And the memory was of sitting happily under a rose apple tree when he was probably, you know, 9 years old or so, watching his father in the distance, a kind of Winnicottian distance, not too near but not too far, watching his father plowing in the field, when he was suddenly and spontaneously the young boy who was to become the Buddha, filled with an inexplicable joy that, you know, went through his mind and body. And he remembers that joy at the height of his ascetic practices. And he thinks to himself, he feels first, a kind of fear that comes in relationship to that feeling. And then he thinks to himself, and this is the self-analysis part that I like the most. Mm-hmm. He thinks to himself, why am I afraid of this feeling? It's got nothing, there's nothing objectionable to this feeling, you mm-hmm. know. But yet there's a sense of fear. So what's that fear about? And instead of going away from the feeling, he goes towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And he investigates it. He's curious about it.
Right.
And he finds that, oh, look, this is it's a feeling that comes from within. It's intrinsic to my being. It wasn't dependent really on any external objects of desire. It's there, you know, part of my capacity, my feeling capacity in the world. Maybe I've been going at this whole enlightenment thing the wrong way. Maybe this feeling is actually the key to the liberation that I'm seeking. Maybe I should try to cultivate it, or at least give it a chance to be part of me. With a body so ill-nourished, there's no way to support this feeling. I'd better take some food and water.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that moment, according to the story, a young woman appears before him holding a bowl of rice porridge, of rice pudding, you know, symbolic, I think, if we want to reduce it to the breast,
mm-hmm.
symbolic of the breast, of the mother again. And he takes the nourishment and then proceeds on his way, has five great dreams, and then sits down under the tree, under the famous Bodhi tree, and proceeds to his enlightenment. And that experience of the childhood memory is thought to be the key to his middle path, to his middle way.
Very interesting. He sort of gave himself a mother, the mother that he had lost.
Or found the mother. You know, he found the mother within. That's why that Mongolian poem that I told you about at the beginning is so important.
Right.
You know, he found that maternal capacity, I think, with the same capacity that Winnicott talks about
mm-hmm.
in The Therapist. You know, he found that maternal capacity was still latent within him. It wasn't dependent on the lost mother, you know, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It was there in him all the time. And when he was willing and able to embrace it, to first be curious about it and investigate it, and then to take it as part of himself, then he could deploy it. And the deploying of that maternal capacity in Buddhist psychology is called mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I wanted to ask you more about mindfulness as a curative factor, or as a, I don't want to call it a technique because it's much more than that, but first I wanted to ask you about this word trauma that's used, mm-hmm. because I think it seems to be kind of an overuse, and the fear is, I think, that it can get watered down or it can kind of lose its meaning. And certainly trauma, as you're describing it, seems to be very in line with the Buddhist, the word dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to hear you say a little bit more about that and what you actually mean by trauma.
Sure. Well, the definition of trauma, you know, in the world of psychiatry is a confrontation with death or serious injury of oneself or of loved ones that fills one with unbearable affect, that fills mm-hmm. one with, you know, feelings that are too difficult to bear, so that there's an instinctive turning away from the feelings in order to prevent a fragmentation of ego or of
mm-hmm.
self, or whatever you want to talk about it, in order to preserve the ongoing sense of the self,
mm-hmm.
the emotional experience is turned away from. And so that's like the trauma that occurs in war, or that occurs in sexual abuse, or that occurs in natural catastrophes. You know,
mm-hmm.
I sometimes think about that as big trauma.
Right, capital T.
Well, yeah, capital B or capital T. And then within the psychoanalytic tradition, I think stimulated by the work of Winnicott, but then talked about by Stolarow and others, this idea has emerged of developmental or relational trauma,
mm-hmm.
which is sometimes called the, you know, little t trauma, which is the trauma that we've been talking about that sometimes happens in infancy or early childhood when there's a problem with the attunement coming from the parental environment, where infants or young children are filled with a kind of similar unbearable affect, feelings which, for whatever reason, are not attended to adequately in a good enough way, as Winnicott would say, feelings that are not attended to adequately, and so the child is left with an experience that can't be born, that can't be processed. And so the child, in an analogous way, has to turn away from the unbearable affect and create a kind of facsimile of a self that can, that doesn't have to feel what is too, would be too fragmenting to feel.
Right. And I think you, Winnicott, and you refer to that as the caretaker self or the false self.
Exactly. And then in, from the Buddhist side, one of the things that the Buddha emphasized time and again is the inevitability of change, that change is one of the things about life that is ever present and that we can't do anything about. So that no matter how much we want to control things and no matter how advanced we become, and we're very advanced in controlling many aspects of our experience, we'll never be able to control everything, so that death and loss and natural catastrophe and things not going our way, that is going to be part of our human experience, and that the feelings that causes, he called dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
And dukkha literally means hard to face. Dukkha, cause face. Mm-hmm. And do emphasizes something difficult. So there's an aspect to life, the Buddha said, which is hard to face. There's another aspect that he called sukha, which is sweet to face, you know. So he's not saying that there's not joy or happiness or whatever, but only that it won't last, can't last. So this other aspect, which is dukkha, which is traditionally translated as suffering, which is kind of a poor translation, I think, it connotes more of a sense of unsatisfactoriness that is intrinsic to our experience as embodied humans, you know, in this world. There's an aspect that the Buddha called dukkha that I'm saying in the book we could also think about as traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, throughout the book, you create a connection between Winnicott's concept of the emotional stance of the good enough parent or caregiver who can soothe and mirror the infant child, and how mindfulness creates another version of this container.
Yeah.
Would you say more about that? And I guess ultimately my question goes in the direction of, then, is trauma something that we can, I mean, people with who have really suffered very bad effects of trauma, is that something that can be healed?
Well, I think it depends what you mean by healing.
Right.
That article that you liked in the Times, mm-hmm. where I'm talking to my mother, you know, the thing that you picked out of that is the sense that really it doesn't have to heal in order to heal. You know, that grief can go on forever if it needs to and become part of us, because it is part of us, because we all either have or are going to experience just those kinds of feelings, which are evoked in a moment, in a crash, you know, in a horrible experience for some people who experience major trauma. But that experience of major trauma is not outside of the potential experience of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all want it to be. We all want to think, oh, that's happening over there to those people, and I feel so bad for them, but it's not happening to me. And we create that kind of division, you know, between our experience and other people's experience, because we're all secretly afraid that it is us.
Right.
What the Buddha was saying and teaching, I think, was that it is all us, you know, other people's experiences are our experiences. Just as a mother or a father feels their precious child's emotional experiences to be theirs, and that a good enough parent is relating to their baby in just that way. They sense the emotional difficulties. They sense the feelings of the child before the child even knows what's happening. And there's a very delicate and beautiful dance, you know, that has been reduced to being called mirroring, which I don't think does it justice, whereby a parent makes the traumatic emotional experiences of early childhood tolerable for that child. And that infuses the child with a sense that emotional experience doesn't have to be dangerous, you know,
right.
And that intimate experience can actually be enriching, even though it can sometimes be very difficult, as those of us in intimate relationships know.
Right.
It fills us with, you know, all kinds of feelings, not only beautiful, passionate ones.
Right.
And I think that goes, that same way of thinking holds for the traumas that we're all afraid of, that, you know, the big traumas that are happening in the world. Instinctively, we want to separate ourselves from them, but we have that maternal capacity that the Buddha found in himself. We all have that ability to relate empathically. There's a writer named Leslie Jamison who
The
Empathy Exams. Yeah. And she talks about, she says something in that book about how trauma bleeds, you know, so it doesn't stay in one locale, you know. We're all feeling each other's traumas. And that's what ultimately is healing, if there is any healing, is not to feel that you're all alone in the singularity of, you know, the horrible thing that has happened to you,
right.
But that in fact this is a human experience, as painful as it might be, and as distinctive as your own might be. It's not that everyone's is the same,
right?
But we don't have to relate with fear and loathing to what each of us ends up going through.
I wonder, I guess as I was reading through your material again, and just, I guess, sort of pondering the world we're in right now, or the historical moment we're in right now, with just seems like a, you know, tremendous amount of violence. And I mean, maybe no more than there ever was, but certainly through the media and our access to information, we're somewhat bombarded with very, very difficult things going on in the world, things people are doing to one another. And I think that the danger is, for some vulnerable people could sort of go into despair or go into nihilism or meaninglessness. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, the Buddha had a lot of thoughts about that, he was very aware of that tendency to retreat into a stance of meaninglessness or nihilism or despair, and part of the I think the beauty of the middle path that he found was that our hearts are big enough to hold the suffering that surrounds us, you know, that whether or not there's more suffering happening in the world now, which I actually doubt,
right.
But we are, I think, aware of it in a different way. We're aware of it in the entire world, you know, through the media rather than just in our immediate environment.
Yeah.
So sometimes that can feel overwhelming. But I think those that the falling into either despair or basically trying to shut it all out is a kind of retreat from how embedded we all are in this world that that we are a part of, and the sad or compassionate, really, feelings mm-hmm. that are evoked by all the suffering around us, if we're willing to allow those feelings to percolate, then they can give us direction in terms of how we choose to live our own lives.
Right, and how we may choose to act and take action, because the traumas that are inherent in life and in aging and illness and death and those things that are just really part of the human condition, there are in social injustices and there are structural injustices that traumatize certain people perhaps more than others, you know, certain types of, racism or homophobia. And I wonder, it's just a thought that I have that, it's also important to be able to act in the world in ways, maybe this is just a value, but to act in ways that you try to bring about some justice.
Yeah. Oh, of course. I think that's one of the basic questions that people have about the Buddhist approach. They often see it as somehow anti-action, mm-hmm. because there's such an emphasis, I guess, on meditation. People think that Buddhism is the same as meditation, or that meditation is all that the Buddha taught. But the Buddhist teachings, his famous teaching, the first teaching was about the Eightfold Path,
mm-hmm.
and mindfulness was just one of the eight limbs of the Eightfold Path, and he action, right action, or helpful action, realistic action, was another equally important aspect of his teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is true, if you look at Buddhist history, in the cultures where Buddhism took root, they pacified themselves to a degree that making war and conquering territories were not their primary concern.
Mm-hmm.
And they did make themselves vulnerable to invading, warring peoples who ended up destroying the, in medieval India, destroying the great Buddhist universities and cultures that grew up,
mm-hmm.
and even in present-day Tibet, the way that the communist Chinese were able to take down a great Buddhist culture,
Right.
They did it very quickly, at least in terms of conquering the territory,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the minds and hearts.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that's more of a Western Buddhist sensibility? You're saying it's part of the right action and social justice is what I'm calling it, is part of, it's embedded in Buddhism, but it's more of a feature of contemporary Buddhism?
I don't know that it's necessarily embedded in Buddhism.
Okay.
Buddhism was, in its history, it's been as, horrible to women
mm-hmm.
as all the cultures of which it was a part.
Right.
So it wasn't able to transform in a way that, looking retrospectively, we might have wished. But it was definitely, the Buddhist teachings were revolutionary in mm-hmm. a social and political way in his time. He took the word noble, for instance, and used it to talk about his noble truths, You know, instead of saying that people who were born into the Brahmin class were the noble people, he said that people who could actually understand and accept importance of compassion for all people, those were the noble people, you know. So he liked to take the he was very, in his own way, revolutionary in terms of changing people's consciousness. That only went so far if you look at the way the nuns were treated, totally second class. Even in Buddhism, there could be problems.
Well, as you said, it's sort of a reflection on the culture
time. Yeah, well, it tried to transform. It transformed culture in a certain way, and it reflected the culture in another way. I mean, it's part of the culture.
Right. Well, I can't believe it, but we're actually coming to the end of our 50-minute hour here on New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is sort of shocking, but it's just been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Mark, and for you to spend this time with us today. And this has been a really big treat for the listeners. I'd like to thank you for being here. And do you have anything, do you know what's next for you in terms of writing or projects?
The only thing that I know is next in terms of writing was I on my last, the last retreat that I did, the last silent retreat that I did, the phrase advice not given came through my head. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting phrase to try to write a book around.
Very
so we'll interesting. We'll see if I'm able to
advice,
do anything.
Advice not given.
I generally don't with my patients, which is what I primarily am doing, is psychotherapy. I generally don't push the Buddhist side of things.
Mm-hmm.
I try to just be their therapist in whatever way is helpful.
Right.
That might be the virtue of not giving advice, or there may be advice that would be worth giving. We'll have to see.
Very interesting. And you heard it here first, listeners. So once again, thank you so much, Mark. When you do have anything new that you're working on, we would absolutely love to have you back, and to talk to you some more about, your new books as they come up. And I want to say to the listeners, goodbye for now, and please stay tuned for upcoming interviews. Stay tuned. Thanks and bye for now.